Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company live on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime that you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and shows are archived going back to the beginning of the year. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like now to remind people that we are now in the fourth weekday of the KSFR semi-annual fund drive, and in order to stay on the radio, what we do is we come to you twice a year and ask you to make a contribution to KSFR. Joining me right now is Diane Karp, who is from the Santa Fe Art Institute, a regular contributor, listener, sponsor, and all-around wonderful supporter of KSFR. Welcome.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte. Good morning, New Mexico.
And we are also being joined by our guest for today, Samuel Toe, who is former hearings officer of the Liberian Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and he's currently with the Joan B. Kroc Institution for International Peace Studies at Notre Dame. And he will be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the Forum at the College of Santa Fe in a talk titled Truth and Reconciliation, Liberia After War. This is a free event. It's part of the Beyond the Lecture series at the College of Santa Fe. And we're going to be talking for the whole hour about Liberia. But first, I want to encourage people to call us right now at 428-1393, 428-1393. That is the number that you can call to make a contribution to KSFR. Diane, why should people call right now and contribute?
There's a very simple answer to that, and that is if every person had to pay every day for the quality and diversity and access to the voices that they hear, whether it's on KSFR in general or whether it's on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe early in the morning with you, Mary Charlotte, they would end up spending all of their income. I know full well how expensive it is to get these people to come and talk, and they are presented absolutely every day with no cost attached. In serious interviews, you are probably one of the most well-prepared, thoughtful, and intelligent interviewers that I have ever heard on radio, whether it's public or corporate. And the entire community has access to deep, thoughtful questions and very important information that comes as part of the answers from all sectors, from the arts, from the literary sectors, from politics, from political science, from science itself. Every single aspect, the diversity of the voices in terms of discipline, the diversity of the voices in terms of perspective, gives every single viewer a chance to experience a world of ideas.
428-1393 is the number to call, or out of area 1-866-907-5737. That's 866-907-KSFR.
Mary Charlotte?
Yes.
And Diane, good morning. It's Dal here.
Good morning, Dal.
Good morning, Dal.
Good to talk to both of you. I just want to mention another reason to call this hour is a fan of the Radio Cafe has offered a challenge. If we can raise during the next 50 minutes between now and 9 o'clock, if we can raise $1,000 on the Radio Cafe, they will match it. A match of $1,000 if we can do that in the next hour.
So 10 callers of $100 or 20 callers of $50. You know, Sean Conlon made a wonderful calculation. He said if people were listening to commercial radio and the number of ads that they hear per hour at an average listenership of 2 hours a day, they hear 147 hours of commercials per year. We're commercial-free radio. He made that announcement. Somebody on KSFR made that announcement, and immediately the phone rang, and somebody made a pledge of $147.
That's right.
So let's have a pledge of $147. Let's meet the $1,000 challenge. The number is 428-1393. And one thing that we are offering today is a copy of this conversation with this part cut out, but of our conversation with Samuel Toe for a contribution of $35 to KSFR, 428-1393. Let's turn to Samuel Toe now. As I said, he's former hearings officer of the Liberian Truth and Reconciliation Commission and currently with the Joan Beecroft Institution for International Peace Studies at Notre Dame. Liberia is a country that probably many of our listeners barely know where it is. It's on the west coast of Africa. It's bordered by Sierra Leone, Guinea, and the Ivory Coast. Tell us about the founding of Liberia.
Thank you. Well, Liberia actually grew out of an outpost for freed slaves that were freed in the days immediately after the emancipation, after slaves were freed here in the U.S. So the American Colonization Society, that was a corporate institution, philanthropist also, that was interested in repatriating free slaves back to Africa. So they formed this part on the west coast of Africa, and free slaves from the U.S. were repatriated, had to go back to Africa. And they formed a colony on the west coast in between Sierra Leone and the Ivory Coast right now and Guinea. And that was where free slaves had begun to build up their community under the supervision of the American Colonization Society until 1847, when independence was declared. So Liberia was the first black nation to declare independence on the continent, and was only second to Ethiopia in within a community of black people. And after that, we have a political system of 133 years of single-party rule. That was the rule that was dominated by free slaves who had immigrated, who had come from the U.S. And then until 1979, when tension erupted and the urban majority had felt that the wealth of the nation were not equitably divided and they needed greater political integration and inclusion.
So now, let's go back to the beginning for a moment. When the freed slaves were repatriated to Liberia, how did they get along with the people who were already living in that area, with the native indigenous people of that zone?
Well, the history of that interaction has actually been the basis for much of Liberia's conflict right now. All right, and it's terrible how you would imagine people who have lived through slavery will reenact such activities of slavery on other people. I mean, at some point in time, the free slaves had developed a policy of integration. I mean, what that meant for them is to forcefully annex the territories and forcefully control indigenous people who lived side by side. So even when the first constitution of the colony was written, there were no rights given to native people. They would not participate in politics. If they wanted citizenship of the colony or of Liberia, they had to relinquish their indigenous ties. They had to dress like free slaves. They had to adapt the Western culture. And historically, there has been battles fought between the settlers and indigenous people. And a lot of those battles have been deadly.
What are the main languages spoken in Nigeria and in Liberia?
Well, there are 16 indigenous languages that we speak, right? English is predominant, so a lot of Liberians speak English, but there are 16 indigenous languages, and they include Bassa, Kru, Mano, Gio, Kran, and a whole list.
Before we come into the late 20th century, the history of the Firestone Rubber Company in Liberia.
Well, Firestone was actually a corporate project aimed at resuscitating Liberia's economy. At some point in time, the nation was actually running broke. And the U.S., being a patron of Liberia, had offered to give in some money. And then as a means of getting that money back, to have a company that will, for 99 years, grow and develop rubber and export it. So Firestone, that was in the early 1900s, about 1929. And, I mean, the interaction of Firestone and the indigenous people is not so perfect, because there was a need for laborers, and so people were forcefully recruited to go and and work on Firestone Plantation. Even currently, the contract between Firestone and the government has been reviewed because it was for so long a time and the taxes were very low. But it was the presence of Firestone had helped in resuscitating Liberia's economy in those days.
Are they still active in Liberia?
Well, Firestone still maintains a very big rubber plantation, right? They are active, but there are other diverse aspects of our economy that have now shifted the emphasis from rubber and on a lot of other things.
We're talking to Samuel Toe, and he will be speaking tonight at the College of Santa Fe at 7 o'clock at the Forum in a talk titled Truth and Reconciliation, Liberia After the War. And for those of you who are just tuning in, don't forget this is the time of our fundraiser, and we're asking you to call 428-1393, 428-1393, and make your contribution. So what happened in 1979?
Well, in Liberia's history, 1979 is indeed a turning point. The most overt episode was the famous Rice Riot. That was when a mass of urban inhabitants had chosen to protest against the increase in the price of rice. By the way, rice is the staple food in Liberia. So the price of rice was hurting that the ordinary people could not afford. And so they got in the street and protested. And in response to that, the government chose to send soldiers in the street.
Now, this was the one-party government that you were talking about.
That was the one-party government. That was the government of President Talbot in 1979. The government chose to respond to that by sending soldiers in the street and shooting down the protesters. As a matter of fact, about 140 persons were killed. Now, what this did was, the government did not take seriously the constitutional right of every Liberian to protest and to call on the government to evoke their public interest. And so what it did was, it made it clear in the minds of those who were opposing the government that the next time around, the use of force would be an option that they would equally consider. Because in the first place, the government had used force, right? So immediately afterwards, that precipitated the coup in 1980, in April of 1980, which brought in the military junta, the People Redemption Council. So President Talbot was executed in that coup along with 13 of his government officials. And that effectively marked the end of the single-party rule in Liberia.
And what happened next?
Well, what happened next, unfortunately, the junta, the military junta itself, went into the ways of the Truth Party. I mean, they were military people, so the best instrument they knew was the use of force. And so Doe did not hesitate to use force. After that, at some point in time when his power was challenged, he sent soldiers on the University of Liberia campus. They raped students, they shot at students and killed some of them. He actually introduced a new phenomenon of conflict in Liberia, and that was politics based on ethnicity. I mean, Doe had particularly evolved this new idea of centering politics around his tribal people. So as a result, there were a lot of Crown who were appointed to key government positions. In fact, the army became effectively dominated by Crown ethnic groups. And then there were conflicts that erupted between Crown ethnic group and people from Nimba County. The dominant tribes from Nimba County are Gios and Manos. And they were also members of the 17-man military junta that overthrew Doe. So there were frictions that developed. There was a raid. There were two coups attempted against Doe, and there was a raid in 1983 and another one in 1985. Now, what that did was to convince Doe that he had to use force against his people.
Now, this Samuel Doe, in theory at the beginning, was a liberator, but turned out to be just an unspeakably brutal leader who not only used tactics of violence that are too horrible to even talk about on the radio, but also rigged the elections when he was clearly losing, rigged the elections so that he won, to the point where I think I read in your book that one particular election was in the Guinness Book of World Records for the worst rigged election ever.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it had it had gotten the blessings of international observers who were there, among which the U.S. At that time, as a matter of fact, I must admit that the U.S. was one of the biggest contributors to the government of Doha, the biggest patron, as a matter of fact.
Do you know why?
Well, I mean, those were the years of the Cold War, right? And Doha was clearly in opposition to communist-oriented states like Libya and clearly on the side of the West. So it will explain why the U.S. will be so interested in Liberia or in the government of Doha particularly. Reagan had invited Doha to the White House and he had visited at some point in time, right? So irrespective of all of that, Doha was persecuting people back home. He was on a campaign of purge against people from Nimba County. He was just using brute force. And I mean, it took nothing short from another insurgency to have removed Doha, which erupted again in 1989.
So Doha finally was captured, tortured, mutilated, and murdered.
Yes.
And that was by the next group, which was, whose name I can't remember.
IMPFL. As a matter of fact, in 1989, the former president, but then rebel leader Charles Taylor, had led an insurgency against Doha. And the group that became splintered to the MPFL is the National Patriotic Front of Liberia. There was a splinter group to it, which was the independent MPFL, all right? And that was the group that captured Doha, and that was the group that mutilated him. His body was on display, actually, on the Bourgeois Island. And that effectively ended the period of the junta and the period of Doha. But it had come at really horrible cost to Liberians.
And also, it didn't get better in a sense because then you got Charles Taylor. Tell us about who Charles Taylor is.
Well, Charles Taylor is actually, he's an alumni of the American penal system. Charles Taylor was in prison before he launched his insurgency in 1989. He managed to have gone back to West Africa and started his insurgency. All right. I mean, he was just a warlord. He went in, mobilized the ethnic communities, started his war based on ethnic division. He mobilized Mano and Gio people, and then launched a genocidal attack against a Doha dominant Crown Army. In fact, that was how he succeeded in winning the war, because he had effectively played the ethnic card. And then he fought, there were a series of interim governments, Charles Taylor himself were part of some, and then fortunately he got elected in 1979. This was an election that...
In
1997. I mean, this was an election that Liberians had decided to give Taylor political power so that he could give them peace. Because at the time, he had posed the greatest threat to peace. He had the biggest rebel movement, he was well connected, he had exploited enough of the country's natural resources, he had a lot of funds. And he has shown repeatedly over and over in the face of the international community that he could wreck any peace effort. So Liberians willingly gave him political power in an election that he won. But unfortunately he betrayed their trust. And then he instituted a reign of terror. He had persecuted a lot of journalists. He had sent them to prison. Media houses were damaged. Even Taylor sent soldiers on the University of Liberia campus. Quite akin to what Sammy Doha himself had done.
I mean, the history of Liberia since 1979 seems like just a horrible repetition of one group after another, using the same tactics. And in a sense, what you have is a class of soldiers trained in brutality, a number of leaders, and this ever-repeating phenomenon.
And which is why the truth and reconciliation is really important. Because why it is important that we must move away from this era of unlawfulness and lawlessness and impunity, we must also account for them, because without adjusting the future, without adjusting the past, we cannot lay a better foundation for the future. I mean, there are a lot of communities that are aggrieved, there are a lot of crimes that have been committed, and to allow them to go again would be to just support the culture of impunity. So the TRC has been instituted to review and investigate these crimes and to possibly bring to justice the perpetrators.
The TRC being the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We're talking to Samuel To, who is a former hearings officer of the Liberian Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and he is with the Joan B. Kroc Institution for International Peace Studies at Notre Dame. He will be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the Forum at the College of Santa Fe. It's a free event. It's part of the very marvelous Beyond the Lecture series organized by Carol Carpenter at the College of Santa Fe. We're going to take a brief break right now to check in at KSFR into the control room and see what's happening. Are the phones ringing off the hook is the question that is coming into my mind right now. Is there anyone in the control room?
Hi, Mary Charlotte. It's
Hi.
Mary Lynn. The phones have been ringing, but we could hear them ringing more. We still have a ways to go to meet that challenge grant.
We have a challenge of $1,000 put up by a wonderful fan of the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, who, if we can reach $1,000 worth of contributions in this hour, we will have that match. So basically, every dollar that you pledge during this hour and only during this hour will be matched one-to-one. So if you make a contribution of $100, that's actually $200. If you make a contribution of $30, that's actually $60.
And let me add something else. Those of us who live and work within the nonprofit sector know that there is always the question of when donations are made to an organization, how much of that money actually goes to accomplishing the jobs and the programs that the organization presents to the community. And I can tell you for a fact that KSFR is a fabulous investment. This is an organization where almost 100% of your money goes directly to giving back to the community, whether it's better quality broadcasting equipment. We now reach into parts of New Mexico that were never available before. I used to
through 101.1 right, FM, our new frequency.
I used to drive to the airport on a regular basis, and I used to bemoan the fact that somewhere around Cochiti, I lost KSFR, and whether it was the BBC that I was listening to, or whether it was Democracy Now! Live from New York, I couldn't hear it. With the new transmission equipment, we now have a further reach. And all of the brilliant people that work, whether it's the news section, or whether it's Mary Charlotte Damande, or the afternoon programming, the jazz, the classical music, the contemporary music, the dissenting voices from every sector of the community, we have the ability to hear so many different perspectives. And all of this comes to us, if we're not willing to bear some responsibility, absolutely free.
I love the fact that a moment ago you just said we, our signal.
It is our signal.
You, Diane Karp, consider yourself, as you are, part of KSFR. Every listener who's listening right now is part of KSFR. And a lot of listeners write to me, write to info@ksfr.org, write to Dal, write to Bill Dupuis. We actually, this is such a small community. It's not like we've got millions of people writing in. We have dozens of people writing in, or maybe hundreds over the course of a year. So we actually are able to listen to and respond to most of them.
We do answer our emails. It's
we
true.
Do answer our emails.
Yes, you do.
At
I
least I try.
Good.
I get 20.
Well, we correspond all the time, Diane.
I get 26,000 emails per year. So we do our best. Dal, how are things going in the pledge room?
Things are busy right now. Now that you guys have been talking about the challenge, the phones are ringing, and I'm thrilled to see it. And when we next have a moment, I will tell you who we need to thank. But right now, they're writing feverishly.
Great. 428-1393 is the number. 428-1393. We want our phone volunteers fevered. We want our phone systems stressed to the maximum limit. If you're calling out of area, it's 1-866-907-5737. That's 1-866-907-KSFR.
I'm going to go take my medication, and thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Go take your fever-reducing medication.
And I'll be back in a while.
And for those of us who live in Santa Fe, I know it's a small community, and we talk about how wonderful it is to live in a small community where we can know so many people. But we can never get to hear the ideas and the opinions of all the different aspects of our community unless we listen to public radio, KSFR.
So we're going to return to Samuel To, but Just one more time, the telephone number, 428-1393. It's not trivial. You are never going to hear Samuel Toe on commercial radio. And if you do, it's only going to be for about a minute. We have the great blessing to have an hour with this marvelous and very special person who has come a long way to be with us and who's dedicated his life to work that is very difficult, very challenging in a country that has suffered brutality that most of us can't even begin to imagine. This is his life's work. Talking to him and people like him is my life's work. All we're asking you to do is take 1 minute out of your day to support this and to make a phone call, 428-1393, 428-1393. Samuel Toe, let's talk about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission process. When in Liberia's history was this process begun, and what was the model that you used?
Well, all in the process of the peace negotiations, there have been close to 14 different peace accords that have been assigned, that have been signed in the course of our conflict. And all in the course of these peace accords, the issues of surveillance, the issues of human rights have not factored in them. In fact, as a matter of fact, impunity and amnesty has been a constant feature of these peace accords. I'm talking about blanket amnesty. So civil society organizations and rights groups have consistently demanded that we can not continue to brush off the issues of accountability. We cannot continue to grant amnesty to perpetrators who kill and murder our civilians. We have to bring an end to these.
Now, the question in a truth and reconciliation process is always that walking the line between amnesty and moving on, moving forward, putting the brutal past behind you on the one hand, and bringing perpetrators to justice on the other hand. And that is a very difficult line to walk, especially when you have a justice system that you are building from the ground.
Exactly. And those are the difficulties that Liberia has gone through. Those are the difficulties that other countries that have had Truth and Reconciliation Commission have had to go through. I imagine that the South Africans themselves found it very difficult. They had a very model TRC out of which we had adopted ours, all right? And the purpose was to bring an end to impunity, at least to begin to start the process of addressing issues of impunity and to address the issues of victims. Because, I mean, every state that has survived situations of such atrocity and have obligations to victims. I mean, they have the obligations of truth. Victims must know the truth of what happened to them and their loved ones. They have the obligation to deliver justice. They have the obligation to ensure that reparations are paid. And they have the obligation to ensure that those crimes are not repeated in the future.
That's a lot.
Yeah, I mean, for societies, it may seem a lot. What is the most sticky part of it is their obligation to give justice. And what the TRC is trying to do is to fulfill a basic list of those obligations. The TRC is investigating the truth of the Liberian conflict. The TRC hopefully will rewrite the contentious parts of our history. The TRC will propose a reparation plan for victims of the conflict. All right, and it is also going to propose institutional reform for the security apparatus, reform for good governance. But the issue is justice, and when I say justice, I talk about the legal, judicial aspects of justice. Will perpetrators be brought to justice?
So was the Truth and Reconciliation Commission given the ability to investigate, to bring people to justice, to try them, to have subpoenas? You know, I mean, there's people who don't necessarily want to go along with the work.
Yeah, I mean, the difference between the Liberian Truth and Reconciliation Commission and that of South Africa is its powers are a little reduced. The South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission could grant amnesty. The Liberian Truth and Reconciliation only recommends amnesty.
And to whom do they recommend?
They recommend amnesty to the President of the Republic, and they send a final copy of their report to the National Legislature. And periodically, the president goes before the national legislature and says to what extent those recommendations by the TRC have been implemented. So by law, the government's under obligation to implement the recommendations of the TRC. So what we are doing right now is we are investigating violations within the period of 1979 and 2003. That was the year the conflict was effectively ended. And all categories of crimes are being investigated. There is a restriction on the category of crimes that the commission can recommend for amnesty. Crimes, war crimes, crimes against humanity are not pardonable under the law of the TRC. So if you are a perpetrator for those crimes and it is established that indeed you are accountable to those crimes, it's likely that you will be recommended for persecution.
We're talking to Samuel Toe, who, by the way, if you were just tuning in, will be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the Forum of College, at the College of Santa Fe, at their Forum building. The talk is titled Truth and Reconciliation, Liberia After the War. What is the role of the Liberian people in the truth and reconciliation process? Are the media functioning well? Do you have good radio and TV and newspapers and so on that explain what's going on?
Well, those infrastructures are not at their best, but the commission has done its best to engage the public. All right, there is a public outreach program that the commission has, and as a matter of fact, is a policy that before we even begin the process of statement taking, there is a mass mobilization of the different communities around the country. And there is currently a nationwide statement-taking process that is going on. What precedes that statement-taking is mobilization, education, sensitization. So the communities so far have been cooperating. They have been giving statements. There are in excess of 3,000 statements that have been collected from various communities across the country. And there is currently a diaspora project of also taking statements here in the U.S. and other parts of West Africa where Liberians lived during the course of the war,
where
as
they
refugees.
Fled or lived,
yeah.
As refugees.
Yeah, where they lived as refugees. And I mean, it's a challenge, really. It's really a challenge with very low funding and with very little staff personnel. It's just a limit to what is possible. But I mean, to a really good extent, the process has been going on successfully.
Since 1979, under this tremendously brutal rule with a series of brutal leaders, the people of Liberia on some level must be terribly traumatized on a psychological level. How do you work with that? What kind of healing process is going on?
Well, I must confess to you at this point that there are communities in Liberia who do not want to hear about the period of the conflict. They do not. I mean, in my
just because you don't want to they don't want to relive it.
They don't
it's too
want
horrible.
To relive the trauma. And this is one problem that we're having with some communities in our country. I mean, I had visited some elders within a particular area in the Liwa counties, and they say the elder had actually said, "We have forgiven these people. We don't want to hear about this TRC. I mean, these people, they are our children. We've accepted them back in the community. It's finished. Don't come back here with your TRC thing." I mean, it is to the extent that people do not want to relive. They do not want to be retold about the atrocities that they suffer. But it is a challenge. And there have been a lot of civil society groups. The UN has a unit within its mission that works on trauma and trauma healing, psychosocial section. And the commission actually has outsourced the responsibilities of psychosocial assistance to these victims to a lot of other NGOs. So there is a partnership there. A lot of them have been working in this area prior to even the establishment of the commission. So they have made inroads in working with victims prior to our establishment. And these are the groups that we've been working with.
When you say that the elders of certain communities say, we've taken these people back in, we've forgiven them, we accept them, and we're moving on, does that process of forgiveness work? In other words, people who have done terrible things, who are reaccepted into a community, Does that then become a functional community?
Well, in very small communities where these perpetrators themselves, where the boys and girls who went on the farm, their parents are still there, they are still family members within the community, you expect that these parents will eventually forget and take these kids in, because after all, they are all part of a big family. But if you get to higher national level, those kind of reconciliation and forgetfulness cannot be true, cannot be effective. Because on the whole, you might have chances of reoccurrence of these incidences. So for smaller communities, they do need to reconcile and do need to forgive. Because after all, they're all members of a single family. They make farms adjacent to each other. They all share the same well within the community. So it's hard not to forgive and not to reconcile with such a person.
We're talking to Samuel Toe.
But the question then becomes, we're talking about the larger culture and the communities and the elders. These young people who have gone through this military violence have been traumatized as well, whether they're the victimizers or the victim. It's a traumatic experience, and to take someone else's life, to brutalize other people, these young people need to have a mechanism, not just to be forgiven, but to be allowed to heal, to reconstruct how to be a good citizen in a democratic situation, how to become part of a constructive part of a community or a family or a farm community. And until they begin to address the trauma of these young victimizers, they have nothing but to expect that at some point they will revert to the behaviors that they were taught were successful.
And Dan, you made a very good point. I mean, these were kids who were recruited at ages 9 and 10.
Oh, they were kidnapped.
Yeah, they were. I mean, they were child soldiers. That is against the law.
Yeah.
So in the first place, they were victims themselves, made perpetrator. So there's a complex situation. How do you address that? And the DDR process, the demobilization, disarmament, reintegration process, had hoped that it would reintegrate these young people back in the community. I mean, to the extent that that process has not been so successful, we're beginning to have some problems. Because here is a big, and as a matter of fact, Liberia is a majority young population. More than 53% of Liberians are young, below the ages 35. So you have a big population of young people who have had military engagements, who themselves are traumatized. What do you do with this population?
I think there's another issue that I wanted to ask you about was, when you have so much destruction in villages, there is probably a cultural loss that is happening, as well as the loss of individual loss of life.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, a lot of religious areas were damaged. All right, mosques, churches were all victim. They were all devastated in the process. And as a matter of fact, at some point in the conflict, there was a concern that cultural heritage and those kind of issues were under attack, because there were certain practices of people in northern Liberia, for instance, that were incompatible with some of the other opposing fighting groups. Like, they would come and run in their sacred butchers where aliens and strangers are not allowed to go. And because they had arms, they would go and destroy them. And that was a source of conflict at some point in time. That was a source of a particular fight. Sometimes that was in 93, 94, all right? And it is a concern. And, I mean, the indigenous people, the traditional leaders have fallen away. I'm not really sure how they have done that, but we still see a vibrancy of these different cultures living side by side. So I'm convinced that they have successfully found a way of addressing it.
We're going to take a very brief break to go back to the control room, hear a couple of spots from our beloved underwriters, and check in on how things are going at the KSFR Fund Drive. And we're back with Samuel Toe. Quick check-in at the control room. How is the KSFR Fund Drive going? Have we reached our goal?
No, but we're so darn close, I can't stand it. We are very close. I have some people to thank, Mary Charlotte.
Oh, good.
Catherine Archer loves Mary Charlotte.
Thank you.
So do I. Jill Heppenheimer, dedicated to the two dissenting women voices, Diane and Mary Charlotte.
Yay.
Commonweal Conservancy. I'm sorry, I got off mic there. Commonweal Conservancy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kathy Wells, thank you, Kathy. Kathy Sullivan, Elizabeth Brizard, Patricia Turner, Roberto Gallegos. This is going well.
Yay! Thanks to all of you and all of you who are listening now and have not called yet. Please call right this instant, 428-1393.
We can do this by 9 o'clock.
428-1393, the $1,000 challenge. We can meet it. One thing that strikes me in all of this, you have, Samuel Toe, a process from 1979 to 2003, 24 years of horror going on. Where was the UN? Where was international opinion? Where was the United States, which was responsible for founding Liberia in the first place?
I mean, the first question we have to address is, where was the U.S. in 1990? If you read the accounts of the inception of the war, the U.S. had two large battleships right off the coast when the war started. I mean, there were huge and serious street battles going on in Monrovia, and the U.S. had two battleships just off the coast.
And they did nothing?
Well, they did nothing. Practically, they secured the U.S. embassy, all right? I mean, the foreign policy was we could not go in, and there were so much justification for why the U.S. did not go in at the time. But what I can say is that at that point in time, it was real that the slightest tangible intervention of the U.S. would have made a difference. Would have made a difference. All right. Here's a population who line up on the beaches just to see the U.S. gunship. All right. And the militias would just, I mean, in my view, they would have listened had the U.S. said, "This must happen." I mean, you saw when George Bush President Bush had insisted that Charles Taylor must leave now, and Charles Taylor did leave. This is how influential the U.S. has been in Liberia. And the question remains, why didn't the U.S. intervene in 1990? When a lot of lives would have been, the loss of lives would have been prevented even more.
And so Liberians in some sense felt betrayed.
Well, a lot of Liberians felt betrayed by that. I mean, in Liberia we call the U.S. Uncle Sam. We have a patronage of America back home. So, I mean, a lot of Liberians were disappointed, and a lot still are. But there are improvements in this relationship. The Liberian president has just recently spoken at the U.S. Congress. And I must say also that the U.S. has been one of the biggest contributors to peace missions in the country. It had supported the ECOWAS Peace Initiative back in the early 1990s. It had also supported and is currently supporting the U.N. mission here. Right. So it is helping. The U.S. had helped, but a lot of Liberians still felt that at the early years of the war, much could have been done.
I think you bring up an interesting point when you talk about Liberians calling the U.S. Uncle Sam. I mean, we call our own government Uncle Sam, but sometimes first world countries do adopt a patronizing or parental attitude where they consider industrial countries adults and third world or developing countries children. And I mean, did you feel that was the attitude of the first world, and particularly of the United States?
Well, at that time, there were a lot of Liberians in politics and outside who looked to the U.S. who would practically take any advice from the U.S., all right? And even fighting forces at some point in time were regularly in telephone connection with the U.S. embassy, as a matter of fact, all right? I mean, Prince Johnson was recorded calling Tango, Tango, Tango when he had captured Duo in August of 1990. All right. I mean, it is believed that he was calling the U.S. embassy. So this is to the extent that the U.S. has had tremendous influence in what has happened. And even down today, we still have a really, really strong and serious connection with the U.S. And I'm happy that even right now, they have just extended the temporary protective status of Liberians living here in the U.S. For another 18 months. That will help. All right, relieve some of the burden that it would otherwise have posed on our struggling economy. And right now, I think the U.S. is trying to rebuild its image back in Liberia and trying to help.
We're talking to Samuel Toe. What was your role as hearings officer in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
Well, to go back a little bit, prior to that time, I had served as the secretary on the selection panel. That was the panel of ECOWAS and UN representatives that selected the 9 commissioners. So I was also a member of the selection panel, and after that I went on to work with the TRC, first as programs officer and then as hearings officer. I mean, my job as hearings officer was basically to create criteria upon which statement givers will be selected for public hearings. Now, public hearings means that the victims and the perpetrators can be brought together publicly before the media and the stories can be told. We call that the testimonies of the victims. So that is a forum that victims come and say what happened to them, what happened to their families, what happened to their loved ones. And I work with victims to preparing them for those kind of public forums. The logistical requirements were also huge, and I had to like work on them, set a schedule for nationwide hearings around the country, make sure that we had public address system, that the media was covering hearings, that those perpetrators who were willing to attend these hearings were facilitated, that victims themselves were aided in coming forth to these public hearings. So basically, those were around the areas that I work.
And what is your role now at the Joan B. Kroc Institution for International Peace Studies at Notre Dame?
Well, I'm studying peace, international peace studies, peace and conflict studies at Notre Dame. I was invited to join their program immediately after my training back in South Africa, and I accepted their invitation. So currently, I'm going through a set of courses in peace and conflict studies at Notre Dame. And I must mention that currently there is a project that is about to start that will begin to take statements within the Indiana area of Liberians, all right, within the diaspora.
There's a lot of Liberians in Indiana?
Yeah, well, there's a good number of Liberians there. So we're currently implementing a project that takes their statements, analyze them under the supervision of Minnesota Advocates. That's a human rights group that's based in Minnesota. And then our report is compiled, and then we send it back to the commission.
Well, we are running out of time right now. I'd like to thank you so much for spending this hour with us here on KSFR.
Thank you for having me.
Samuel Toe is former hearings officer of the Liberian Truth and Reconciliation Commission. He's with the Joan B. Kroc Institution for International Peace Studies at Notre Dame. And he's speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the Forum at the College of Santa Fe. His talk is entitled Truth and Reconciliation, Liberia After the War. It's a free event, as are all the events in the Beyond the Lecture Series at the College of Santa Fe. We've got just a moment left to go back to the control room and also to turn to Diane Karp, who's very quietly spent this hour with us as well.
It was an amazing hour, and I just want to ask all the listeners out there, when was the last time you heard a conversation that was so thoughtful and so thorough and so enlightening about a nation that is in large part of the American history? The media in Liberia, certainly under Charles Taylor, was completely repressed and destroyed. And in order to build a new and democratic and open society, they need a media that has the ability to speak truth. And speaking truth is something that is complicated and challenging, and we are fortunate to have it in the U.S. with public radio stations like KSFR and interviewers like Mary Charlotte Demandi. So help us out. Give the same amount of money you might spend on lattes for the next month, and you will be able to double your money and take KSFR a step further in solving the problem of raising money from the community, because we are community radio.
428-1393 is the number. You've got just a couple of minutes before we go. It's almost 9 o'clock. It's 2 minutes before 9 o'clock. 428-1393 is the number. If you're calling out of area, 1-866-907-KSFR. That's 1-866-907-5737.
Mary Charlotte.
Yes.
Yes, the answer is yes.
Y-E-S.
Yes, we did. And I want to thank some people real quick here. Earl
Excellent.
James, Collected Works Bookstore. Thank you so
thank
much,
you,
Dorothy.
Both of you. of you.
Alexandra Eldridge loves Mary Charlotte.
Thank you. We love all of you.
Emily Drabansky.
Emily.
A woman from Little Compton, Rhode Island named Agnes Langdon.
That would be my
mom. Yes.
That's my mom. Thank you, Mom.
Yes. I got some more. I just got to get it in my hand here. Lynn Marchand. Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you.
Look forward to seeing you soon. Emily Drabansky. I mentioned that already. Thank you, Emily. Yes, we made our challenge.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much. Yahoo. Thank you for your respect and for your contribution. And for those of you who have not yet contributed, 428-1393 is the number. Please call now. And thank you so much for supporting this marvelous gem of a public radio station, KSFR.
Your mom and I are having lunch in December.
But I want to remind everybody that just because we've met our challenge, it doesn't mean we're done.
Good for you, Diane.
We are so not done. We have to get to the end of this fundraiser. If everybody who's listening would call right now, the fundraiser would be over by the noon news. You'd be ringing the phones off the hook. Let's do it.
We're almost at $50,000, which would put us at the halfway mark.
That's the halfway mark?
Not good enough.
Let's do the other half. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Thanks to Dal Dearman. Thanks to all of our wonderful phone volunteers, Bill Dupuy, and everybody else at KSFR. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. The number is 428-1393, 428-1393. Inscribe that number on your dashboard, on your paper, on the inside of your cranium, and call now, 428-1393. And thank you so much. Hasta la vista.
Adios, Mary Charlotte.
Ciao.